My lords, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very honored and pleased to be here to speak to you, and thank you for inviting Lloyd's to participate in this important debate. If you hear a little wavering in my voice, it's an electronic problem, not me. Part of the reason for the waiver might be that, as Rupert said, many other people are experts in this field. Unfortunately for me, many of you are here tonight. Climate change is an issue we take very seriously at Lloyd's, and understandably, it significantly affects our business. It's an issue we've been looking at for many years. We believe in order to tackle climate change and adapt to the wide-ranging and long-term impacts, governments, business, academia, other organizations, as well as us as individuals, will need to work together. Therefore, activities such as being involved in this debate and speaking to stakeholders across society to address the climate change issues is very vital to us. Perhaps I want to talk. In my presentation, I'll provide a brief overview of Lloyd's, very brief. If you want more, I'll happily talk to you later. And then talk a bit about our work on climate change, as well as looking at the impacts of climate change on our industry and why it's so important for us to help address this issue. At the end of the day, an insurance enterprise is merely a reflection of the society it serves. We're a warehouse of other people's money. We want to make sure we have enough to pay those who need it when they need it. And maybe over time, if we're really lucky, we might get to keep 5p. So you remember that 5p later when we talk. So the role of insurance in society, again, not trying to teach too much about the warehouse of other people's money. We basically are here to protect businesses and help post-disaster. We're a post-loss solution to climate change problems. And we are also a bit of a thermometer on what happens in the economy and the costs of climate change, and perhaps one of the first places you see it. Having said that, since all of you buy motor insurance, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the feeling that many insurance payments are merely taxes, just soft taxes done in a way where you don't have to abuse too many voters when you're doing it. So it's a great form of soft taxation. But I think that's an important point to remember as we go through how insurance can be a role in how we help with climate change. So if we, just a quick thing here, and it'll also is a number that, given what you said, Rupert, about what gets spent on climate change, just to put it in perspective, Lloyd's writes roughly 2% of the world's non-life insurance premium. So of the total, and that's about 22 billion pounds of insurance premium a year. We write in 207 countries, we write 63 lines of business, and quite a few of those are touched and touch in many ways on things that are affected by climate change, not just here in the UK, but across the world. And one of our core businesses, a significant percentage of our premiums come from property insurance, property treaties, property catastrophe, property direct and fact business, all sorts of jargon that helps me keep my job. So that's what we do, and it's very important to understand what's happening with climate change. Lloyd's also, just as a quick reminder, is not a single entity. It's roughly 54 businesses managing 88 syndicates. And so it's a quasi-mutual. You have a bunch of guys who run their own businesses, and I sit on top of them. I give them an extra layer, $2.4 billion of capital in case they blow out. And so I'm sort of the underwriter for the central fund to protect those guys. But it's a very robust thing. And as a result, and because of our worldwide presence, we participate in most anything bad that can happen. I was at a wedding in Cincinnati, Ohio on Saturday. Some wonderful young woman from New Zealand came up and started complaining mightily about a barge that had tipped over and was spilling oil on the beach where she was about to have her wedding in January, if they could clean it up in time, and did I know anything about it? And sadly, I did. But anyway, so if we look at this, we try to participate in a lot of different ways. One of those is organizations such as the Geneva Association, the London Climate Change Partnership, the Department for Energy and Climate Change, and the Light Hill Risk Network. We were one of the founding members in 2007 of ClimateWise initiative and signed up to the ClimateWise principles. My fellow who heads our emerging risks area, who unfortunately couldn't be here tonight, Trevor Maynard, I think he may have the tattoo, but he does wear the ClimateWise pin every day. So we do have a lot of people who are very devoted towards the issue, and look at part of what we do at Lloyd's in its broader social purpose, not just running a market and trying to make money from the insurance enterprise. This is a few of our snapshots of our recent reports that relate to climate change. There's quite a few. I'd encourage you to go look at them at your convenience at our website, which is lloyds.com, and no apostrophe. And we'll talk about a few of those. A few further words on ClimateWise. ClimateWise is the global collaboration of leading insurers focused on reducing the risks of climate change. It was launched in 2007 by His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. ClimateWise brings together over 40 international members from Europe, North America, Asia, and South and Southern Africa, all of whom agreed to abide by the ClimateWise principles. These principles include commitments to support and undertake research on climate change and to support climate awareness among our customers, including, importantly for tonight's discussion, encouraging them to adapt to climate change. We remain very active member of ClimateWise, and we're involved on many of their subcommittees. The impacts of climate change are increasingly well recognized, as you've heard from the two previous speakers. From rising temperatures to rising sea level, they're having a significant impact on business and insurance industry as well as society as a whole. Not in the UK, but we've paid out a pretty big slug of money earlier this year on the Australian floods. We commissioned a hydrology report to really understand, you know, which event it was. The problem in insurance is you tend to pay people based on events. When you have various types of flooding or precipitation activity, sometimes it's hard to distinguish why exactly it flooded, and whether if you release from the dams in order to protect the other people so you make an economic trade-off, who actually pays that, and trying to sort that out is sometimes easily determined by having a hydrology report, which we commissioned on behalf of the market. So those are the sort of activities we would get involved in. One of the most easy way to see this is that between 1970 and 2010, the number of natural catastrophes increased by over 300%. That number can be very confusing, and you can hide a lot of things with it. It also includes a few earthquakes as well as weather-related events. But most scientists attribute a significant proportion of the increase in storms, temperature extremes, droughts, wildfires, and floods to climate change. And we spend a lot of time trying to figure out and forecast what happens in the mid-Atlantic and how that happens. Is it, you know, when Mount Pinatubo went off and there was greater particulate in the air, was there a greater amount of storm activity, cloud formation, and those sort of thing? So we spend a lot of time sitting around trying to guess what might be a factor and try to understand that as we try and set the rates for hurricanes. The biggest one being Hurricane Katrina, which cost the industry in actual insured damage about $55 billion. This year, we paid to put it in perspective, natural catastrophe costs in 2010 for the whole year, for the whole world, was roughly around $27 to $29 billion of insured loss. Economic loss is far bigger. In the first quarter of 2011, again, driven more by the earthquake in Japan as the bigger number, but the total number there is a range estimate from sort of $35 to $55 billion just in the first quarter alone before you add into the effect of the tornadoes. Now, I'm not sure that the tornado in Joplin, Missouri was a result of climate change, but it had wind speeds in excess of 200 miles an hour, which is more powerful than most hurricanes hit the shore. It killed more people in a hurricane than had happened since 1943. And to put it in perspective, if you could imagine a swath of London, 1 mile wide and 8 miles long, totally flattened from what it looked like today, the same type of development. It took out an entire hospital. It was a pretty amazing display of what nature can do. And it's one of the most severe things we've seen in recent time. And there was an equally large amount of tornadic activity in Alabama and some of the other cities earlier this year that was uncharacteristically extreme. Now, whether that's an effect of climate change, just a confluence of events, the trouble is we're trying to measure our pulse between heartbeats here. You don't get enough data points to really tell what's happening. But we do spend a lot of time with people trying to speculate, and we're huge consumers of science and information to help us have a better idea on trying to think about the odds of natural disasters. So, If we look at that, this is talking about the economic losses. Just to put it in perspective, insurance doesn't cover everything, which is what you're talking about in terms of whether you can prepare and mitigate, whether you can address it some other way. Because in 2011, our economic losses so far this year are $265 billion. 2005 was the cost of this year previous of $220 billion in economic damages, largely driven by three hurricanes, Katrina, Rita, and Wilma, that caused that. And so if you look at the insured losses, where we say that there's those have gone up nearly 10 times. Why is that so much? If your number of catastrophe that I gave you before, whether that number is exactly right or wrong, it's like 300% or three times. If insured losses have increased 10 times, part of that's because more people live on the coast. And so if you have a demographic shift to where you're putting people in more and more exposed areas, and it's not just, by the way, from climate change, one of the reasons the damage in Christchurch is so dramatic, and they've just condemned another 1,000 houses, because of the liquefaction on the delta where the city fathers encouraged people to build homes on the delta. And in the earthquake, it proved to be sort of a disastrous environment, and they're not going to allow anybody to rebuild there. 95% of the central business district, by the way, in Christchurch has been condemned. And so right now the government there is trying to figure out, do you rebuild there, do you rebuild somewhere else, which is a similar discussion to have on issues about floodplains after your, as you said, it's a lot easier to prepare things before the fact than it, or prepare preventative defenses than it is to remediate afterwards. And later on I talk a little bit about that. So if you look at the impacts of climate change on our industry, we expect floods to increase. In Australia, the underwriters only being slightly lighthearted when they say, you know, you guys have a flood every year. And how are we supposed to figure out, well, how do you insure something that has about 100% probability? It's a tough thing. And it's not really as bad as that, but it does move for change. If you look at the Christchurch, just to give you another idea, the Earthquake Commission pays for its reinsurance about 1.5% a year. Until they had, last year, they had an earthquake in New Zealand and that totaled the program, about a 4-point-something billion loss. And there was a $6 billion loss in the one that happened in February. And so they've totaled the program twice, and they raised the price this year to 3.5%. And over time, and I only mentioned it's an earthquake example, but it's a good way to think about it. One of the ways insurance works is we help spread the losses of the few among the many. But you can't forget that sometimes if you want to develop, if you want to live in Christchurch, if you want to live in Auckland or Wellington, there isn't enough money in that economy amongst the 6 million people living in that country to pay for the rebuilding of that country should things go wrong. And it's the same premise if you want to build out the flood, you know, along the Thames. If we had a really material event along the Thames, the economic costs are pretty dramatic, and who in society is going to pay it, whether you pay it through insurance, whether you want to pay it through government. In the U.S., they have a flood program that's sponsored by the federal government, and that encourages development in certain places where, in reality, I'm not convinced a rational person would build a home. But if you can get your cost spread amongst the taxpayers of the United States, it may be a perfectly sensible and rational idea. So that's mostly flooding we talked about in the previous speech, so no point in dwelling on that. Now, here's something that I think actually is close to my heart, in that if you think about climate change and the innovation quotient of U.S. attorneys is unparalleled. So if they're looking around and trying to find something as a new class action to do, because in the U.S. if a guy does a class action, the lawyer involved gets about 30% of the award. So it's economically incented to try and redress society's wrongs, which is what it was started for, but it's a art form now. And to date, no comprehensive climate change legislation has been enacted in the U.S., and the uncertainty, well, on the one hand you say that's a good thing, on the other hand the uncertainty over this regulation leaves insurers open to unexpected decisions and changes of law. Because we sell a promise to pay today, and not everything's claims made, and so the old state-of-the-art defense is out the window, and if there's a new way that you should have known to build your building in a certain way, and in fact I know for a fact after Hurricane Katrina, there were quite a few lawsuits when, because you, there was a fabulous picture looking at the other, another loss in Florida from that same series of storms. And there's, you know, pretty much devastation for as far as the eye can see. And then there's two buildings just standing perfectly in place. And you can't, it's not clear why. It's not like they were materially different construction. But you can be sure that the guy who had the building on either side was suing his contractor for why it didn't stay up. And there's those kind of activities where you try to decide how do you handle the things where you have uneven construction, and more importantly, as you do have post-disasters, uneven results. So we think over time that there is something coming. In 2009, the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S. ruled greenhouse gases are pollutants and are a danger to public health. They announced their intention to require major greenhouse gas emitters to publicly publish their emissions. Such regulatory action is a radical step towards apportioning clearer responsibilities for the causes of climate change. However, currently that EPA ruling and its legal standing to make such decisions and such disclosures of people's individual polluting amounts is being challenged by a number of states and individual senators. It's a, soon to be a presidential election year. This ball will stay in the air for at least that time, I think. Climate change, again, just going quickly, may lead to geopolitical and security tensions. The water scarcity, food security, energy and natural resource scarcity, I think could cause unrest and conflict between states. How does that affect us? We probably are one of the largest political risk underwriters in the world. So when you have what happened in the Middle East happen, you know, in Egypt, for example, there's a supermarket chain called Metro, and we paid for the stores that got looted. So we're involved in all sorts of aspects of business all over the world where if climate change isn't addressed, some of the side effects are indeed going to hit us in a variety of lines of business that we work on. So to stick with the what we're the theme of tonight is that it's starting to have an impact now. I believe your estimate that people aren't really fully reacting to some of the things in the future. Very few people know or seem to buy into the notion of we've already polluted the world in a way that 20, 40, and later we're going to be paying for those sort of things. Therefore, we think it's not just enough to recognize and monitor the situation. We have to learn to adapt when levels change, and I'd like to talk to a little bit about what we're trying to do to facilitate that. And we try to not only raise awareness through what we're doing with climate-wise, but we also have some of the best thinkers on the planet in terms of, okay, what's happening with the cost of a hurricane, what's happening with your risk, and that's where the taxing argument I mentioned earlier comes in. If you don't build your property right, there's a fairly sophisticated modeling system, RMS. I don't know if our friend from RMS is here. Yep. But the RMS models, and you should ask him later for more detail about them, but they actually speak to the various aspects of some of the construction, the quality of the construction, and its vulnerabilities to that. Those bits of information feed into how we build our exposures and exposure management, how we aggregate up our probabilities of loss across Lloyd's as a business, as well as the individual businesses taking the risk. And so the modeling will respond to the fact that, that to give you an example, the Miami-Dade County Schools came in and said that the new RMS model discriminated against school districts. I said, well, I can't believe anything discriminates against school districts, but because they have a lot of tilt-up large concrete buildings, and those were shown to be more vulnerable in the last hurricane. In a sense, the model does discriminate against that, but it's hard to argue it shouldn't. And so we are trying to get pretty sophisticated, so that taxing nature, in the sense that if you have a riskier property, you're going to pay a higher premium, should encourage the right kind of behavior in terms of remediation and trying to address those kinds of issues. So the other thing that can happen is regions can become uninsurable. There's quite a few guys who look at New Zealand, for example, or look at Australia and say, I'm done. I can't figure out how to write this business and spread the cost in a rational way over time and not just keep asking all my other contributors of premium to pay out for this loss that we are pretty sure is going to happen. So the roles for insurers throughout all stages of the adaptation process, we can basically do things in terms of the sustainable claims process as well. So it's not just whether we tax you a little differently in the premium we charge, but we might actually be able to, when we rebuild or replace or offer to resituate, in order to mitigate the effects of a claim for somebody, there's ways that we can impact climate change in that regard. So, sea level rise is one of the most well-recognized things, and this I'd encourage you to look at this report on our website about it, and it talks a little bit about hard engineering such as flood defenses and seawalls, elevating properties, and a few other things, and changing the characteristic property to make it more resilient and resistant to flooding. Though when we put this stuff out, that's also to not only get people to be more aware of it, but if we educate our intermediaries who educate our policyholders, we then have an opportunity, I believe, to try and make a difference, both in terms of reducing the overall economic costs as well as reducing our insured involvement. Lloyd's study found that sea level rise of 30 centimeters may more than double the average losses for some exposed properties. In almost every case study in this report, adaptation would reduce the future losses to below today's levels. There's no single solution for managing coastal flood risk, and you have to tailor it to meet each thing. But we're probably right more U.S. coastal flood risk than most. And so I think that would be the main thing. One last thing, risk-based pricing and the role of governments. Oftentimes, governments have a different agenda when they set a price for risk. When you're doing, you want to encourage economic development. If you want to encourage foreign trade, there's an entity called MIGA out of the U.S. sets prices for political risks that don't seem to have anything to do with anybody else's sense of the risk. It's an inducement to get things done. And so in natural catastrophes, we put out a report here very recently that said you ought to try and come up with a risk-based pricing approach set by a reasonably independent third-party arbiter, away from the social agenda, in order to really fully determine the costs of risk. Sustainable claims management I mentioned, and last we do a little bit of work in microinsurance down in South in Africa and other places, trying to raise awareness and help the smaller economies. We worked with some of you. I don't know if you in the Met office from here worked on that project, but. We're trying to see what's the opportunity for longer-term forecasting. And to quote one of the guys who runs one of the insurance companies at Lloyd's, is it a lot better than a coin flip or not? And we try to see what we can do to really extend the science and work with people to see if we can get to that. And collaboration, if you just remember the word, that's most of what I had to say tonight. We'd love to collaborate with everybody involved and share information that we get. Work with the data that we get. We do have a pretty big mine of data. At any given point in time, we're paying about 200,000 claims, and so we get a lot of information from that. So lastly, I'd say insurance has a pretty important role to play to work with you on this climate change and adaptation. We can perform a signaling role in terms of if we set our prices and risk grids in a way, you say, well, that I don't want to pay that much, so I could entertain those changes to my home that will mitigate the cost of the increased insurance if I don't. There's a taxing way that it also sets the taxes, so those people who do want to live in the areas that are more at risk do pay more. And then lastly is protecting, because the impact of these changes is not going to be every day gradually over time. It will be sporadic and it will be sharp, and that's how people seem to come to a greater sense of a problem. We never knew we could have three hurricanes in a row across Florida and up into Texas. So that's the basic thing. If you could look at the signaling, taxing, and protecting, that's the way I think we can work best with you. And I look forward to any questions later.